In the summer of 1989, I went on a walking tour of UC San Diego. I was a high school student, hometown Long Beach, and at this point I already thought I wanted to go to UCSD. A couple of my friends from Long Beach Poly High, who were a year ahead of me in class, they went there, seemed to be doing great. So I'm down in La Jolla, I'm on the campus at UCSD, and this is one of those typical San Diego days that we've all become used to if you live here for any length of time. Temperatures in the low 70s, couple wispy clouds, and otherwise blue sky. I mean, just a picture-perfect day. Our tour guide is leading us through the various points of interest on campus. There's the giant library that looks like a spaceship, featured in Star Trek II, we found out. Here are the woods that include a couple electronic talking trees, very weirdly and randomly dishing out poetry to unsuspecting passersby. It was when our tour guide got to the old student center, though, that I decided it was time for me to break away and start my own tour. And it wasn't for the bike store, it wasn't for the vegan co-op or the coffee shop. None of those things pulled me away. No, it was a dark, shuttered building with a heavy wooden door and a handful of posters and band announcements taped to the windows. It was the student radio station, KSDT. I didn't know it at the time, but I was home. And for the next 4 years, well, if we're being honest, the next 5 years, KSDT would become the place I honed my craft as a budding radio man. Counterintuitively, what attracted me to this tiny, dusty student radio station was its sports program. It had none. There was one upperclassman there who was the quote-unquote sports director. He didn't do any sports. I looked at this, I took one look, and I said, you know what, this is where I need to be. Now, you have to understand, I was 17 going on 18 at the time. But even back then, even in 1989, I already knew what I wanted to do as an adult. Over the past few years, I had been developing my sports fandom, but with a particular ear for radio play-by-play. See, I grew up with the greatest possible teachers you could have, offering me master classes nightly on the air. For baseball, Vin Scully. To me, probably the greatest announcer any sport has had on this earth. Bob Miller for hockey. Intense, precise, reliable. You could listen to a Kings game with your back turned to the TV. Bob would let you know when the team was in trouble or when they were on the attack, when you needed to shift your attention. And for basketball, my all-time broadcast idol, Chick Hearn. There wasn't a time of year that one of those three Hall of Famers wasn't on the radio. I grew up listening to them, taking little bits from each of them, and thinking, you know what, that's what I want to do. I want to call games on the radio. So when I saw that at KSDT, there was essentially an empty vehicle to start working on my radio play-by-play chops, well, I hopped into that empty vehicle and started working on hot-wiring an engine. In the fall of 1990, we called maybe a dozen or more UCSD men's basketball games on KSDT. There was a little plug-in that had been hardwired years ago at the old student gym, and we used to walk across a card table and our out-of-date equipment from KSDT around the quad into that old student gym where UCSD played their Division III basketball games. We did some baseball games, some softball, but the basketball team was actually good. They won over 20 games my freshman year, and they made the Division III NCAA basketball tournament. In fact, over the next four seasons, the Tritons would make the D3 tournament three times. They even hosted a tournament game once. We had some good players on those teams. Tim Rapp, Darvin Jackson was our point guard. Eric Johnson, the redhead that could shoot from 25 feet. John Spence at small forward. Chris Moore hitting baseline jumpers. Remember driving up to Redlands to call games back on the student radio. Honestly, I don't remember how we hooked up. I think we had a phone inside a milk crate. There might have been some mice inside a spinning wheel. This was way pre-internet, and seriously, I have no idea how we did it. During those years, though, I learned some basic stuff, and I learned some not-so-basic stuff. I certainly learned some things about my craft. For example, I learned that you can't just invent a special radio play-by-play call, a signature call. It really needs to come organically. When I started, I thought I had it figured out. I thought whenever a UCSD player would hit a three-pointer, I would use kaboom. Kaboom. But then a kaboom. It was terrible. It was not good. Gave that up after a year. I also learned that no matter how hyped you were for the game, you couldn't give up on the game if your team was losing. You couldn't start moping on the air and just give up on the action. Yeah, that happened too. End of freshman year, not a proud moment. I learned that when you're on top of a dugout at the baseball field calling a game, and there are maybe just friends and family in the crowd, but they're right behind you, and then you start freaking out over what a great play the third baseman just made, and it was actually on a foul ball, people will hear you, and they will laugh. They will laugh at you. I learned that. I also learned about starting and maintaining a relationship with a head coach. Tom Marshall, UCSD head coach back in the day. Learned what that feeling was like to call a game, maybe be critical of a decision, and then be back in that office the next morning talking to the same man you just criticized. Got to say thanks to Coach Marshall for those office chats, for learning about the per-minute efficiency ratings of Khalil Allen and Nate Hampton, watching practices, one practice after another, and actually starting to understand the choreography of what was happening on the court, how the picks worked together, how one play could lead to a next. I also learned at UCSD, doing student radio, about what it meant to deal with a sports information director. What happens when you interview an administration official? I really learned about the difficulties of seeking money from student government to fund a road trip for a basketball broadcast that nobody can hear. By the time I left KSDT, I had taken a turn at the station's program director's job. I'd spun the wax tracks, a DJ both at 2 in the morning and 2 in the afternoon, called dozens of games across a handful of sports. And sometimes I do wonder if our student walking tour hadn't gone through that particular corner of UCSD's old student center, if things would have turned out differently. Probably not. Maybe so. These days, it's a completely different world for a young, aspiring broadcaster. I mean, the generation's difference, amazing. You don't really need a student radio station anymore. Anyone can start a podcast from home or start blogging, even set up a live radio show from your computer. It's much easier to get started in this business these days. Much harder to get noticed, to have your voice stand out from the crowd. There are opportunities galore, but teaching yourself huddled in front of your computer in your office is not the same as working with others in a common environment under the same roof. I know KSDT is still in the old student center. I was there last year and walked by it. I'm not sure they do sports anymore. In fact, as far as I know, their last sports pod broadcast very well might have been May of 1995 before I left campus. UCSD plays in Division II now, and in a full circle moment, for a few years, I got to call their basketball games again, this time on the real radio. I shelved the kaboom call. From the Mighty 1090 to Mighty1090.com, this is the Craig Elston Podcast. Welcome to it. Podcast number 6. Craig Elston here with you. Hope your week went great. Mine was okay. Mine was all right. Not the week I was anticipating having. Everyone who knows me, if you know me, you know I work in the Sockers. San Diego Sockers. This is supposed to be our big playoff time. We lost our opening round playoff game. Just a stunner. Stunner. To a team that the Sockers really are strong rivals with, dislike, a team that they did not want to lose to, the Las Vegas Legends. And instead of spending the whole week hyping up a Sockers home playoff semifinal, I've been licking my wounds, catching a cold from my three-year-old. Here's something great that happened this week, talking baseball with Bob Chandler. That's our guest today. Bob Chandler is our guest. I've had the chance in my life for 5 different seasons to be a semi-regular host, either a completely regular or a semi-regular host for Padres pre and post, hoping I get the chance to do that for the Mighty 1090 in 2015 in some aspect. The last time I got to do it for this station was 2013, where I did all the weekend pre- and post-game shows with Bob Chandler. Got to spend a whole baseball season working with Bob. And frankly, that goes right there, in the top 5 of great things I've gotten to do in my career, work with Bob Chandler, a man who has literally been here for just about everything that's happened, at least over the last 50 years, in San Diego sports. Bob and I got the chance to chat at the Mighty 1090 in the conference room earlier this week. That conversation is coming up momentarily. Some of the things you'll hear along the way, and Bob is like just the exact right guy to talk to about this. How about the last time that the Chargers were in danger of leaving San Diego and there was a vote on a stadium? Did you know that happened back in the mid-60s? Just about 4 years after the Chargers had arrived, they were set to leave again? Did you know about that? How about when the Padres were all but gone for Washington, D.C.? Bob Chandler was there for the meeting when Padres employees were called together in 1973 and told, you probably will be working in D.C. next year, if not later this year. That story, Tony Gwynn, Jerry Coleman, so many memories, a time in this business that was completely different from now, the golden decade of San Diego sports. Which one is it? Our guest has a very strong opinion on this subject. Let's bring him in. Bob Chandler on the Craig Elston Podcast.
See, which of these things controls the whole overall noise level or sound?
Probably this one for you. Okay. To go up or down. Yeah, a little down, right there. Right. You're the opposite of Tenny. Tenny goes up and then all the way up and then get another machine to turn it up high.
Who does?
Liger.
Oh.
I had to crank to max when he and I did this.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. Well, you know, it's... years sticking those earphones in, in my eardrum, whatever. Finally, now I've got hearing aids because by the test, it shows it's blowing out the high frequency noise. So we really have trouble when a woman talks because it's a higher voice, whatever. I could understand Ben, no problem.
Yeah.
But the higher voice women, I really got a problem. So got
what
the
a
hearing
great
aids
excuse.
Now.
What a great excuse. Honey, it's not that I'm not listening to you. It's my broadcast career, I swear.
That's it. I'm sorry. But see, that may be what happened to the cat, and he doesn't know it yet.
Right? Oh, my gosh. That could be – this could be the unexplained phenomena. There's so many places we could start, Bob, and I – people don't know how much of an Aztec basketball fan you are. This week is Aztec Tournament Week, right?
Yeah.
It's Mountain West
yeah.
Conference Tournament Week. It's where I'm going to be heard the most this week on the station. What are your thoughts on this team this year? I know you're out there watching them play all the time.
You know, I kind of, to me, this team is kind of like a baseball team with a good pitcher who because he's good, he keeps you in the game.
Yeah.
But you still have to score some runs to win.
So, in other words, Randy Jones on the mound, mid-70s Padres.
That's about it. Yeah, good point. Good analogy. And this basketball team, the defense is good enough to compete with anybody in the country, except maybe Kentucky.
But, yeah.
But any reasonable college basketball team. The question is whether how much they're going to score. You know, watching the game just the other night, their final game with the seniors and whatever, and so Steve Fisher started Dwayne Poli, and the team looked totally different to me. I mean, he brings so much athleticism and bounce and whatever to the team that I thought, wow, I'll be surprised if he doesn't start Poli in the Mountain West Conference tournament.
He's every time he takes the court, I get nervous. Bob, I'm not going to lie. I mean, he went down right in my line of sight. I was courtside for that game. And when he went down, it's like his head was going down right into my line of sight. And I watch his eyes roll back in his head. I'm a guy who I told the story a lot at that time, but I went to broadcaster summer camp, Bob Miller's summer broadcaster camp with Roy Engelbrecht at Loyola Marymount University. Ooh. The last summer that Hank Gathers was alive. And he was a camper. He wasn't just an athlete on campus. He attended the camp to become a future broadcaster. People didn't know that about Hank Gathers. Before he started his NBA career, before he started his senior year, he wanted to be a broadcaster in the future. And so this was like one of the first guys I was really, as an 18-year-old, super invested in his future career. He dies on the floor that next season. I see Poli go down. I said at the time, if I was his dad, I would never want to see him on the court again. Say, son, let's get started with your academic career.
Well, you know, and obviously all the information after he went down, all the tests they were running. And then I found out for the first time, I don't know how many people knew, that he had actually collapsed a year before during a practice. I didn't know that. I had no idea that. And so that made it doubly scary to me. But my gosh, they've gone through every possible test. Six different doctors have cleared him, and apparently when he missed a game a week ago, they had to adjust the medicine. That was all the problem was. And I mean, he looks the same out there. He's bouncing around, but you have to wonder in the back of your mind. Gosh, you know, wouldn't it be awful if?
Oh, exactly. I mean, there's no upside to me that matches the downside risk. But that's just me. You know, I mean, that's me. I know. That's how I look at things. But I'm not the one who's staring at the million-dollar possible upside as well of moving on to professional sports career. So that we could spend 40 minutes talking about that. That's the fact that I got a 3.5-year-old son at home. Mm-hmm. It makes me think differently, you know?
Yeah, I'm sure, and I have no doubt about this, that San Diego State would not let him go out there and play if there was, you know, if they thought there was even a 1% chance.
Yeah. He's got that monitor, happening. I guess. He's actually got a real stats monitor, mm-hmm. in a way, in his chest. So after the first game he played, they're like, we don't like the metrics. You sit out a game. Okay.
Yeah.
Just the fact that the metrics move around makes me nervous. I was trying to get you last week, golf. Golf is a huge part of Bob Chandler's life. That is one vice I'm so proud I've never taken on.
it's addictive. It's very addictive. You know what? I play a lot. I'm not very good, but I love the game. I just love the game. And so I keep playing, you know, and I play with a bunch of old baseball guys. Most of you know them. You know Roger Craig and Bob Skinner and Alan Trammell, Norm Sherry. Steve Arlen, who pitched for the Padres, Freddie Norman. I mean, these are all Dave Campbell, who was a broadcasting buddy and a Padre player, and who's here for a few months because he has a daughter in North County. So those are the guys I play with.
Who's the
a
best?
Lot.
Who's the best of the group?
Best of the group is Trammell.
Yeah.
the young athlete, the young dude who can hit it out there 260, 270, you know, and is coordinated and athletic and all that kind of stuff. And the rest of us muddle along. Craig was terrific. Skinner was terrific. But these guys are getting up in their 80s now.
Right.
It doesn't go as far as it used to.
There are about 14 punchlines that on the course would be filled in right there. So travel still got a little bit, huh?
Travel still has a little bit. But you know what? Because of golf and handicaps,
yeah.
I mean, you could play no matter how you match the teams. It's usually a foursome out there, two against two, and you adjust the strokes accordingly. And it's very competitive. And I want you to know, I can choke on a 3-foot putt for a dollar just as much as those pros can for thousands of dollars.
So, in other words, we want Trammell on over that putt, not you.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's great when he's my partner.
Oh, that's awesome. I remember you telling this story of basically that becomes a fired manager's foursome at times.
Well,
right?
it was fun. It just came up. I was talking to Bruce Bochy when he was managing the Padres. And I said, hey, Boch, I just happened to think I played golf today with three guys who've all been fired as major league managers. And it was Alan Trammell. He'd been fired by the Tigers.
Right.
And Norm Sherry had been fired by the Angels. And Roger Craig had been fired by the Padres. And old Boch, with that straight look without cracking a smile, he says, I'll tell you one thing, Bob. I'm never playing golf with you.
He's definitely avoided you since San Francisco. He's done a well of a job.
You know what? I think with three World Series titles in 5 years,
yeah,
he's pretty safe.
He could even afford. He's like, I'm not starting now. He even thought about it. Hunter Pence broke his arm. That's a segue for me, though. Who do you think is the best Padres manager? You've had a chance to evaluate them all.
You know, different ones had different strengths. Dick Williams turned everything around when he arrived. He's a tough guy, and he didn't care who you were. You know, this is what we have to do to win. And if you won't do what I want you to do, there's a spot for you on the bench. And that's the worst thing you could do to an athlete is put him on the bench, not play him. And he took over a Padre team in 1983. He took over in 82. In 81, the team was awful. You know, it was Frank Howard year. He had a strike, and we're terrible. It was essentially the same players in 82, essentially the same players, and they were a 500 team. It was, and I credit it almost all to Dick Williams and for establishing a standard for which they would play. I remember one time, I'm doing the statistics, you know, for the team. In those days, now it's all computer.
Right.
But then I had to type it out each day, and brings back bad memories. But he saw me computing one day on the plane. He said, batting average, you know, that doesn't mean anything. The real statistics are, does he get the guy in from third with less than two out? Does he advance that runner from second to third when there's nobody out? Those are the kind of things. Does he miss signs? Does he do this? Does he do that? And that's what was important to Dick. And it was those little things, to me, that he emphasized that turned that Padre team around. And in 1984, because they improved the talent a little bit, a guy named Gwynn joined the team, Kevin McReynolds, Alan Wiggins stole 70 bases. They picked up Greg Nettles. They had Goose Gossage in the bullpen. So there were a lot of things. But that was the first pennant.
Yeah, and Dick Williams, obviously a Hall of Fame manager. And I think of a guy in modern baseball that's like that. And the guy who comes to my mind, Bob, is Buck Showalter in Baltimore, a guy who's come into multiple situations where a team, either an expansion team in Arizona, in New York, when they were terrible, and before he collected and organized it all, and then Joe Torre picked it up and won championships with it basically a year later, and then what he's done in Baltimore now. And that team, and it's always through that emphasis of fundamentals, of really kind of getting into doing the details perfectly. And that's what I just heard from you in terms of what Dick Williams was emphasizing in a time where he didn't have the backing that he would have had from an analytics department in a major league front office these days.
Yeah, well, that's true. And Nick, next to Dick would have to be Bruce Bochy, but Bochy, for a lot of years, didn't have the same kind of talent, that Dick eventually had with the Padres. But I watched the way Bochy handled players. That's how I judged him. Never publicly criticized him, but, boy, they were in his office a lot with the door closed. And he never put them down in front of their teammates or whatever. But he knew when they messed up, and they knew, too, after talking to Boach. And so I just liked the way he handled people. And I've always thought the strategy end of baseball for managing a lot of times is overrated. You can call for a hit and run. That might be the perfect play, but if the batter swings and misses and, you know, the guy gets thrown out, you know, running, then it looks like a bad play. Or put a bunt on and he pops it up or fouls it off, those kind of things. The manager can't totally control that. He can just put it on when it seems like the right time to do it. But it's handling pitchers that is the most important job for a manager, in my view, handling the pitching staff. And Dick Williams did that well. Bruce Bochy was brilliant. And my opinion, Buddy Black is just outstanding. Come on, for him to milk 77 wins out of that Padre team last year, which was the worst offensive team I've ever seen in Major League Baseball.
My gosh.
And I've been involved in Major League Baseball for a long time.
I've seen some really bad teams.
And some really bad Padre teams. But I've never seen a team that inept offensively as last year's team was. And still he won 77 games. You know, I thought, wow, that was all pitching. And now they've improved an already strong pitching staff for this coming year. And obviously the offense has improved. I mean, there are still some question marks about this team on defense and speed and left-handed, right-hand, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But this team, I think everybody will agree, is going to score more runs.
It almost has to.
Yeah.
Right?
How could you score fewer?
You can't. You can't. In fact, it's made – you know what's funny about that, Bob? It's made not even being critical, but just – analyzing, like having critical analysis of how the Padres have attacked the winter, it's made it difficult because people are giddy. They're punch drunk giddy. They're like, wait, we've got guys who can hit home runs now.
Yeah.
We've got Matt Kemp and Justin Upton. And anytime you go, well, you know, we're going to strike out a lot. This team's awful right-handed. Wow, boy, the outfield defense is going to be rough. They're going, wait a second. Cameron Maben, Carlos Quentin, and now you want to tell me we're going to be worse with Myers and Kemp and Upton? There's no way in the world.
Craig, this is a team that had a team batting average last June of 171.
I was there.
171? That's one hit every six at-bats.
Oh, my gosh.
That's beyond awful.
They overachieved. There were days they overachieved to get there. I looked at the lineup and said, there's just no way. No, it's exciting. The move that – there were two moves that excited me maybe the most. Shields, because when we looked at this pitching staff, there's one thing that I think you have to talk about is that Andrew Cashner as a starter has never had a full year without going on the DL. And Tyson Ross is the same way. He's had at least a spot on the DL, and he throws that slider all the time. When you add Shields, you add durability. No matter what you get in terms of his performance, you're going to get durability. You're going to get 34 starts. You're going to get 215-plus innings, and that's going to help those other two guys because now if you get 180 from Cashner and Ross, that'll be fine. Instead of being a big problem because they're your 1-2.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. And I hearken back to 1998, the last time the Padres were in the World Series.
Yep.
And their big offseason acquisition was Kevin Brown. In my opinion, Kevin Brown was a more dominant pitcher than James Shields is.
No doubt.
But they're both number ones. They're both really good starting pitchers. They're both durable. They're both going to go to the post every 5 days. And with Kevin Brown leading that staff, Andy Ashby had the best year of his career. Joey Hamilton had a terrific year.
Right.
And you had a pitching coach, Dave Stewart, who really emphasized, I don't want this six innings quality start stuff. You know, I want 7-8 innings out of you starters. Made the bullpen better. Trevor Hoffman, 54 out of 55,
something like that
year. And the pitching staff was just terrific. Well, I think Shields can do the same thing for this team. So I think just the way you described it. Coming in, he's the number one guy that takes that number one onus off of Cashner and off of Tyson Ross. And I don't think any of us looked at Ian Kennedy as a number one, but he's a good, solid starting pitcher.
Yeah.
And he's the one who did give you over 200 innings last year.
Right, and so now here's your four.
Yeah.
I think there's just such a huge difference kicking a guy down a notch.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and saying, okay, now you're the number four guy. Now you're going against a guy who, for a lot of second division clubs, is going to be that rookie out of the minors. It's going to be that guy that's kind of a swing man. And you're throwing out a kid who's supposed to go to the post 33 times for six innings each time. So that's a big advantage. It means now Moro and Despaigne and Erlin are all fighting for one spot instead of taking up two spots. And it most importantly means when someone gets hurt, you're one step further up the depth chart.
You know, you mentioned Despaigne and Moro and Robbie Erlin and Matt Whistler, the number one pitching prospect in the minors. These are the guys dueling for the number five spot. Craig, I can remember years when I would have taken those four as the top four members of your staff. You'd have been thrilled with that. I mean, look at what Despaigne did last year. I mean, he did a terrific job. Now he's fighting for a spot and the number five spot on the team, and there's no guarantee he's going to get it. And whoever, it's probably going to be he or Morrow. And whoever loses will be your long guy. And you still have Erlin and Whistler. And Erlin pitched some very effective games last year. Whistler we haven't seen at the major league level yet. But, you know, he was one of the few prospects that A.J. Preller saved.
Right.
And so he must like him.
Yeah. And that it's actually amazing he was able to keep kind of like the quote-unquote top three or three of the top four through all of these moves. Yeah, it's funny you said that about this. There were years that I would have taken that. I could think of a couple in the years that I've done this, but what was like maybe the bleakest year going into the season for Padres baseball that you remember?
Well, that's easy. 1973.
Yep.
Because the main reason was in May of that year, the Padres and the Phillies were battling for the worst team in baseball. It was only May. And we played the Phillies a doubleheader in San Diego, and they beat us both games. And Jerry Coleman and I are wrapping up the broadcast, and somebody came in and said, when you guys are through, there's a team meeting downstairs, an employee meeting. So we go down to this employee meeting where we were informed by Peter Bavese, was then the general manager, that the Padres had been sold to Washington, D.C., and would move at the end of the season or maybe even during the season.
Hmm.
And so that had to be the low point.
Absolutely.
The low point of my Padre career, and it was only my second year, full year, doing the games. And that was really a bad team. That was a terrible, terrible team. We had a shortstop named Dwayne Anderson, who they picked up later in the year. And he was very consistent because he batted like 140 left-handed and 140 right-handed. He was a switch hitter. And the worst part about it as a shortstop, he fielded about the same. It was just awful.
It was 140 to his left and his right.
Oh, in fact, the Padres had traded Dave Campbell to the St. Louis Cardinals in a deal and got some money along with Dwayne Anderson back. And I often needle Campbell that you were traded for the worst baseball player I have ever seen. And Dave said, yeah, but the Padres got some money back in that deal. And they did. They did.
Well, that evened it out a bit. Well, you know, it's great that you brought that up because that's one of the things I had written down that I wanted to talk to you about. Obviously, here in town, we're in the midst of one of these crises as a fan base, looking at the prospect, which I think is a very real prospect, that the Chargers are going to be gone at the end of this year. And heading up to L.A. On a huge venture that is bankrolled by Goldman Sachs, one of the most powerful forces on earth. But you're a guy who can speak very, very, you know, obviously to a previous time when this team was gone goodbye, the San Diego Padres. You're describing that board meeting. Why weren't they the Washington Senators or whatever they were going to be?
Well, you know, this was the Padres' fifth year in San Diego, but they had signed a 20-year lease. And so later in the summer, you know, the Padres went to court to keep the team in San Diego, and the judge ruled, no, you cannot stop this team from moving if they want to move. But yes, you do have grounds for damages for the 15 years remaining on the lease.
Hmm.
Well, that scared the daylights out of Major League Baseball and the National League. And they wanted Joseph Dansansky, he was the Washington, D.C. grocer who had purchased the team, to be liable for any damages that this, you know, that a San Diego jury might determine the worth of the team in San Diego for 15 more years. And that put everything in limbo. And Dan Zaski said, I can't do that. You know, it could ruin me. You know, ruin my business, you know, if it, well, whatever. And so as an addendum to that, you'll notice, Craig, that no team moves now until their lease is up. Mm-hmm. Or they can make a deal with the city to get out of the lease. Now, the Chargers have such a deal with the city of San Diego, so they can move. But that was kind of revolutionary at the time. And so that really put the team in limbo. And the Padres were actually going to be operated by the National League in 1974 when Ray Kroc, bless his soul, sailing on his yacht off of Florida, and was a nutty baseball fan, read in the paper about this Padre team being up for sale. That's a true story. He told me this. He said, I turned to Joan Kroc. I said, honey, I think I may buy the Padres. Now, Joan didn't know anything at that time about baseball. And Ray said she looked at him funny and said, Ray, why would you want to buy a monastery? He said, no, the Padres are a baseball team. And you know what? Within a week, he owned the Padres. It happened that quick.
What was the circumstance in San Diego that led to the need for the Padres to want to leave? What? How bad was it? What was going on?
Well, I can tell you this. The best attendance in the first 5 years was 644,000.
For the year, yeah.
For the year. That was the best. That was the best. And then Ray Kroc bought the team. Craig, I'll never forget his news conference. I can picture it now. It was at the Westgate Hotel downtown. See, Arnold Smith, who did own the team, owned the Westgate Hotel. So they had,
that worked out.
Had this news conference there. And here was Ray in his mid-70s now. And he, you know, the chairman of McDonald's, he was one of the wealthiest men in the world, had basically done it himself. With a lot of vision and a lot of guts and a bright idea. So anyway, he's standing up in front of this mass media, and it was the biggest turnout I had ever seen for a news conference in San Diego. People all over the place. And he has no PR guy. He's by himself. He stands up, and he's answering questions. And somebody asked him, well, Ray, you know, attendance has been an issue in San Diego. What would you be you know, what would you think would be okay? And he said, oh, I don't know, maybe 700,000? After all, what do I need with more money? Well, Craig, when was the last time you heard a sports franchise owner say that?
But I think anyway, that was the last time.
but it resonated with the fans. They fell in love with this guy. You know, my God, he's not in this, obviously, for the money.
Right.
He loves the game. He loves baseball, whatever. And so that 74 Padre team wasn't much better than 73, Craig. It lost 102 games.
Wow.
Lost 102 games and drew over 1 million people for the first time. That's up from 644,000 to 1 million. And I attribute it to two things. One, the Padres did acquire Willie McCovey that offseason. And Willie was a magic name in baseball. He'd hit some home runs, whatever. He was a guy who was fun to come out and watch play.
Sure.
And Ray Kroc, the fans related with him. They knew he was not to gouge him. He was willing to pay anybody. This is before free agency.
Yeah.
You know, he would have brought anybody in to improve that baseball team. And they related to him. And from that point on, you know, San Diego's drawn 1 million plus every year since, except for a strike year.
How many years, because you used to do for the Padres something similar to what I do now for the Sockers. How many years did you broadcast and also work in a front office capacity for the team?
Well, I was doing the statistics. Was Buzzy Bavese was the guy who hired me. And he somehow convinced me I needed to do the statistics, whatever, which took about 2 hours a day, you know. Because I had to get everything by hand. Looked up the batting averages in that little sporting news book, batting averages at a glance. And then I had to type it out on a stencil, and then they would run it off, and that's how you did it, you know, in those days.
Right.
And then I was part of the Speakers Bureau, ran the Speakers Bureau, making, gosh, how many talks I made in those days. And later on, I did some publicity, some public relations. So for a long time, I would say for, hired me full-time starting in 72, yeah, for over 10 years.
Over 10 years, yeah, doing that kind of work.
Along with the broadcasting.
That's what I mean.
Which was the part I loved.
Right. And if we, I'm even going to dig deeper back as we continue. But I'm just curious about that dynamic at that time. You were dealing with teams that I want to say until 78, you didn't have any winners to talk about at all. Right? And then, really, I mean, through that whole period, one or two teams that were worth a hoot. How did you manage that dynamic of being on the air? You're commenting on a team that's tough. You're also working behind the scenes. You're involved in it at every level. And, you know, in most circumstances, especially Major League Baseball broadcasters or club employees, that's not unusual. But I'm just curious about what that dynamic was like for you, whether you built up an internal armor against the losses or how you handled that.
Well, I learned a couple of things. One, doing those statistics, I learned I could make statistically the Padres sound like a powerhouse. You know, seriously, if you pick out just the positives and talk about them, this guy's got a 10-game hitting streak, this guy has done this, this guy's done, you make him sound great. But it's just statistics, you know. And so I understand how statistics can be very misleading at times. But then in the mid-70s, you started to get some stars. You know, Nate Colbert was a legitimate home run threat. Randy Jones became one of the darlings of baseball. So you had some things to talk about.
Yeah.
And then in 78, they finally had a winning record. That was the first year. It began in 69. So it took the 10th season, 1978, before they finally had a winning record. And you just, and it's baseball. You know, you're talking baseball. And even if, when you're not a good team, and you actually have to work harder when you're not a good team. You know that.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, Jerry and I mean, you had to tell stories. I would try to draw Jerry Coleman out to tell more stories, you know, about the Yankees and whatever. And he was reluctant to talk about his Yankee days, but he did. There were certain stories. And so you tried to make it entertaining as best you could. But starting with Dick Williams' teams in the early 80s, now all of a sudden you were good. You were competitive. And especially in 84, that's when you won the division really from soup to nuts. And people then were hanging on every pitch. So now you're really, and it's more fun when you're doing that. You're talking about the game because the game, every game's important. And they said you could walk along the beach and not miss a pitch. You know, people had their radios out because, my God, the Padres have a winning team, you know, all of a sudden. So that was really fun. That was fun.
So you've really seen that genesis of, I mean, some people take it wrong until I explain it to them, but I always say that San Diego's the ultimate bandwagon city for sports. In terms of, we've got a lot of casual fans who will casually follow the team, but every once in a while we have a good team.
Yeah.
And when that good team rolls around, my goodness, they all come out of the woodwork. And all of a sudden it's that circumstance where you could walk up and down OB and hear every pitch of a game back in the day when radio was a more dominant medium than it is these days.
You didn't have near as many games on television then. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, or never mind that they could be listening on their smartphone to their MLB.tv feed. You know?
I mean, all that's new.
All of that is now a very different how we consume media as sports-loving adults. But nonetheless, what amazes me, though, is what you said early along. Here's the city of San Diego getting an expansion Major League Baseball team, which is really stamping this sleepy little sea town as being in the big time. And, the team stunk. But usually these days you see expansion teams draw, and draw some more, even when they're horrible. Were you surprised that it took so long for people to really even just kind of warm up to the product that they didn't give it a bigger hug early on?
Yeah, you know, San Diego is actually a very good minor league baseball town.
Right.
I mean, there are a lot of people here who love the game, love baseball. But expansion teams were different then than they are now. I mean, now in expansion, you can go out and sign free agents.
Right.
And they actually give the team maybe a couple of years head start to put together some kind of a farm system and get acquire some players. That wasn't the way it was then, you know. And there were no free agents to be signed. Not that the Padres would have signed any anyway in those days. And you were able to select, you know, three players, I think, from each team or whatever. And Buzzy Bavezzi was in charge with the Padres. And he had come from the Dodgers. But Walter O'Malley kind of made an informal deal with him. Look, I will help. I know you want to go to San Diego. Buzzy was with the Brooklyn, and then the L.A. Dodgers.
Yeah.
I know you want to go to San Diego. I'll tell you what, I will help you get a major league team, you know, in San Diego, and that'll be a great deal for you. Plus, it will open up a spot here for my son, Peter.
Nice. Okay. All
so
right.
So all those things were good. However, when it comes to picking our players, I know you know who all the good guys are in our front. The Steve Garveys, the Bill Russell, the Davey Lopes,
yeah.
Bill Buckner. He said, so I will tell you what three players you're taking from the Dodgers. Well, Buzzy, what could he say?
Right.
So they took Zola Versalas, an over-the-hill shortstop. They took Al Ferrara, a good-hitting outfielder, but he'd broken his ankle. He couldn't run in the outfield. And a pitcher whose name escapes me now, but it wasn't very good. So those are the three.
Escapes you for a reason.
Yeah, yeah. But can you imagine how different it might have been for the Padres?
Yeah.
If they had taken, because that was the Padre philosophy, to get young players, you know, and build that way. And instead of the Buckner or the Garvey or the Lopes or Russell, those guys, they had to take these others. Now, ironically, Al Ferrara, and I still see Al every now and then. He worked for the Dodgers now, but in 1969, in September, and you can look this up, and this is a terrible Padre expansion team that lost over 110 games, I believe.
Yeah.
152, lost 110.
Oof.
So the Dodgers came to town leading the National League West, and they brought all the players' families came down, employees came down. I mean, they were going to – it was a four-game series in San Diego. We'll come down, we'll feast on the pods and whatever. Padres swept the four-game series. And Al Ferrara, who was irritated at the Dodgers over some of the things they said, had a hand in each one of those wins.
Really?
And it was fun to see, and it's fun to even talk to Al the Bull Ferrara, talk to him now about it because he remembers that. And it was probably the most satisfactory moment of his career.
And so began the dynamic of the Padres as the Dodgers' occasional shiv in the side.
There was one game that year, Craig, that the Dodgers beat the Padres 19-0.
And earned every point of it.
Oh, yeah. Just awful.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, you've seen so many different things over the years covering the Padres. But, you know, you and I talked back a couple years ago, I remember, at DZ Akins about just how things were in town, working in San Diego sports, working in sports television, working in this industry, which is so different now. But as you described it back in the day, it had to have been a wonderland for yourself.
Well, I think the 60s were the glorious decade of sports in San Diego. And just let me tell you why. You know, first of all, visualize the major sporting event in San Diego in 1960 was the San Diego High Hoover High football game.
That's the biggest.
That was the biggest. You did have minor league baseball, and minor league baseball was good. It drew, and in 1960, they had moved to Westgate Park from Lane Field. The termites won the Battle of Lane Field, so the Westgate Park opened in the valley. It was a beautiful minor league park. It's where Fashion Valley Shopping Center is now.
Right.
So anyway, Triple A baseball was good, but that was it. And San Diego State football was a joke. I know. I was attending school then. They were awful. They were just awful. They talked about dropping the sport. You can't put a good college football team together in San Diego. Kids are all surfers. They don't want to play football. Okay, with that as a background, in 1961, the Chargers moved from Los Angeles to San Diego. That was such an event.
Right.
Such an event. I'll go back to that in a moment. And a guy named Crewcut coach from up the coast named Don Coryell was hired at San Diego State.
Same year.
Well, his first year, 1961, with, with the Aztecs. They went 7-2-1. It was his worst year over the next 10. 7-2-1. He was a phenomenal coach and changed the whole, believed in recruiting, changed the whole atmosphere. And San Diego State would outdraw the Chargers at San Diego Stadium when it opened up in the late 60s. You know.
Wow.
So anyway, so you had Coryell to San Diego State and the Chargers to San Diego. Chargers, by the way, won their division in 61 and lost to the Houston Oilers in the championship. Then in 1965, November of 65, 50 years ago, I might add, the Chargers are going to move. They're playing in Balboa Stadium, just an awful facility. And so you had the vote whether to build a stadium in Mission Valley. And so they voted, 72%, by the way, voted in favor of building the stadium in the Valley. That kept the Chargers in San Diego. See, this happens every 50 years. Right?
And we need about the same percentage, yeah, I'm afraid. Yeah.
And it, of course, opened the door for Major League Baseball. So Major League Baseball came, was awarded in 68, and they played in the stadium in 69. The stadium opened in 67. Then, in 1966, the Sports Arena opened. And that was a huge event. Bob Breitbart built it with his private capital. The first team in there was the San Diego Gulls of the then the Western Hockey League.
Every 50 years, this happens again.
You know? And at that point, the National Hockey League had not expanded to the West Coast yet. So you had the L.A. Blades and the San Francisco Seals. They were, you know, they had glamour cities on the West Coast. But the Gulls were a terrific attraction. They were priced right. They eventually averaged over 10,000 a game playing in the arena. And that opened the door for NBA expansion. And the San Diego Rockets of the NBA began playing there in the 67-68 season. The Gulls began in 66. So all this happened in the decade of the 60s. And now, my gosh, we're in danger of losing our football team, the Chargers. Padres look in pretty good shape.
Yep.
But we no longer have the NBA. And we did just get professional hockey back, which has a chance to be very successful here, I think. It'll be a triple-A, even a higher-level hockey team than the Gulls were in 66.
Yeah.
But I want to tell you, when the Chargers came to San Diego, what a huge event this was. I was working at Channel 8 then as a newsreel cameraman writer. I'd just been hired out of San Diego State. You know, I mean, I wanted to get into sports, but you get your foot in the door any way you can. And so I remember reading the newswire machines that don't exist anymore.
Right.
Did then. You had United Press International. You had Associated Press. And whenever they referred to San Diego on the wire, it was always San Diego, California, you know, 120 miles south of Los Angeles, whatever. But after the Chargers had been here for a while, then it was just San Diego. You know, people knew who the Chargers were, and San Diego had that effect even on the Associated Press and UPI. That may seem like a little thing, but that was a big thing to me then.
Oh man, Mark Fabiani, I hope he didn't just hear that. It's going to be in his next speech tomorrow about how the Chargers put San Diego on the map, literally.
Well, in many ways, it was true. If the Chargers do move, it'll be like tearing my heart out in so many ways. Let me tell you how excited I was about the Chargers coming to San Diego. This is 1961. I've just graduated from San Diego State. I want a career in sports, but I'm starting off in news and whatever. And the Chargers, I can tell you the exact date.
Yeah.
And in a second, I'll tell you why.
Okay.
The exact date of their first workout in San Diego. It was at the University of San Diego football field.
Uh-huh.
It was on a Saturday, July 22nd, 1961.
Okay.
At about 10 in the morning. And the reason I remember that is I was there for about an hour, and then later on that day, I got married.
You couldn't get anyone to fill in, Bob.
Listen, I just went to the workout as a fan, you know, of pro football, whatever.
Oh, my
God. My wedding wasn't until 5 o'clock.
Oh, so yeah, okay. You
know, it was okay.
Smart even then.
And then 2 weeks later, they played their first game in Balboa Stadium, in August 6th, I think it was, against the Houston Oilers. Won the game 27-13, something like that. They were putting a second deck on Balboa Stadium, which was a high school field.
Right.
You know.
And is now again.
And, yeah, but they've torn down that second deck,
right,
and so forth.
That's wow. That's amazing. And then 65, I bet you a lot of people don't know that part of the history of the Chargers in San Diego, that as soon as they were here 5 years later, there was a chance they would be gone.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Because they would – Balboa Stadium, I mean, the capacity was maybe 35,000.
Yeah.
But they rarely got to 30,000 because it was such a bad facility for football. It really was. It was – somebody would spill a drink. And it would just come down all the rows, the concrete rows, you know. It would get you. There weren't enough restrooms. The press box, was primitive even by those standards.
Yeah.
And so.
What was the atmosphere like in 65 when that stadium vote came up?
Well, 72% vote in favor of it. I defy you to find a subject you could put on a ballot that would get 72%.
Oh, I agree with you.
Got to vote for motherhood? Vote for the American flag? You might still not get 72%. But it got 72% in November of 65. And I remember at the time, Craig, people talking, the analysis of it was, wow. And it was a young crowd coming out to vote. I mean, these San Diego is young. They're looking to the future, whatever, da-da-da-da-da. And San Diego was a lot smaller then. You know, I'm guessing maybe 700,000. The city at that time.
Yeah.
You know, it's probably what, 1.3 million or 1.4 million now, something like that.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, about double. Yeah. If not even a little bit more, right?
Yeah, but the city, I can tell you this, the city was excited about the Chargers coming to San Diego. And I, editorial opinion here, I hope they're just as excited about keeping them this time because that's an old stadium.
Yeah. Well, it is. I mean, not to get too far into the weeds on this, but I'm just. My worry is right now, I know you remember that movie Network from the 70s, and when he comes into the boardroom and you're messing with the primal forces of nature, you know, you're messing with forces you cannot understand. Yeah. When you get to the Goldman Sachs level and you know that Goldman Sachs has a point man in L.A. that's working to put a stadium there, a man in St. Louis dedicated to keeping the Rams in St. Louis, and the NFL's own point man for stadium relocation is a former Goldman Sachs banker. When I see all of that aligned, hat tip to Bo Linet, voice of San Diego, who wrote the story that connected all those dots last week, I go, okay, you're messing with the primal forces of nature now. I mean, 72% still might not stand up to a Goldman Sachs truck of cash.
Yeah, you know, it can't be denied. What a huge market Los Angeles is, and when the Clippers sold for $2 billion.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
Yeah, it opened eyes everywhere. So if the Chargers move to Los Angeles, immediately they're worth, I don't know how much more money, but a lot more money. And the fact that, to me, and I hope I'm right, that Dean Spanos has not just done it, you know, that has invested and tried to find a solution and needs a stadium. And they have been working at it for a long time, but, I mean, there are a lot of issues. The economy certainly was a big factor.
Thank you for bringing that up.
And Alex Spanos was the first one who mentioned this but 13, 14 years ago. But at that time, nobody even took it seriously.
Yeah, you're right.
You know, and when San Diego Stadium was built, that the trend then was to build multi-purpose stadiums. Had one in Cincinnati, Philadelphia, New York, Pittsburgh, maybe some other. But those are the ones that come to mind. And of all the ones that were built, San Diego Stadium was by far the best. It could switch from football to baseball overnight.
Yeah.
Those others couldn't do that. It took them longer. It was a majestic edifice at the time. But any time it's a multi-purpose, it's a compromise. It's a compromise to football and a compromise to baseball, and it's not perfect for either one.
Right.
Now, nobody builds a multi-purpose stadium. First of all, football needs more seats. They need a different configuration. Baseball needs a smaller venue like Petco Park, which is perfect, absolutely right. Perfect. And that's the trend now for to have two stadiums, one for baseball, one for football. And the football stadium in San Diego, which once was great, is over 50 years old now. You know, it's time.
Yeah.
It's time for a new one.
It is.
It just is.
Well, I really want San Diego to embrace the idea of thinking about this independently of the Chargers. Because if we just think about it as save our bolts, then when they leave on their own, you don't have a platform to stand on anymore. The threat of them leaving on their own is real, beyond the idea of us coming up with a viable stadium. Let's come up with a viable stadium anyway. You still need it.
Yeah.
You know, you need it for San Diego State. You need it for bowl games. When you're thinking multipurpose now, you should be thinking NFL / MLS. You know, have a stadium that's going to work as a monster, but that you could also either tarpaulin the top deck, or it's got that Seattle fold to it, whatever, so that if the lower bowl is full for soccer, it works great. And then work to get an MLS team here.
Yeah, I love San Diego. I was born here. Dad was a Navy officer, so we moved around every few years. But of all the places we lived, I liked San Diego the best. Came back here to go to college. That was 1956. Been here ever since. And it's my personal observation that when it comes to these major projects, San Diego does it, but doesn't go quite far enough. You know, we built a great convention center, but now we've had to expand it once, and now we want to expand it again. We never built it as big as it should have been in the first place.
Right.
We built, even, I love Viejas Arena, you know, but wouldn't it be nice if it was 16,000 instead of 12,414?
We
don't look what it can be. We don't look at what something can be, not what, you know, right now. So I personally would love to see a combination stadium arena type operation. I think, in my opinion, eventually you would have the National Hockey League here. You may even get the NBA back. I mean, San Diego was not a bad NBA city for both the Rockets and the Clippers. They both left for different reasons. One was the tax situation at the arena, where Bob Breitbart thought he'd been misled about what he would have to pay in possessory income tax, and so he ended up selling the team to Houston out of spite, told me it was the worst mistake he ever made in his life.
Yeah.
And then the Clippers, well, that was Donald Sterling. He wanted the team in his hometown, Los Angeles, and so he ran a terrible operation here and just moved the team to L.A., where he ran a terrible operation there for a long, long time.
Quite infamously so now.
Yeah. So wouldn't it be great? Listen, San Diego is a destination city. People love to come here. They love to come here. Remember Al Michaels on the Super Bowl a few years ago saying, you know, the NFL should just hold the Super Bowl in San Diego every year. This is just great. Well, a lot of people feel that way. I mean, I know in my 35 years of broadcasting for the Padres, every team has a family trip. I'd bet 99% of the family trips from those other teams involve coming to San Diego.
Right.
So my point in all that is, if you do put the resources into building this multi-purpose, football stadium with multi-purpose in terms of an arena where you could have basketball and hockey.
And the soccer.
That you'd get the soccer and maybe even outdoor soccer
know,
in San Diego. Why doesn't San Diego have outdoor soccer? We're right in Mexico. Come on, when they have those games here, they draw it great.
Right.
I mean, it's unlimited what could happen here in San Diego. I understand it's all about paying for it. How do we do that?
Right.
Well, the smarter minds than mine will have to figure that out, but I think they can.
And I really think MLS needs to be something that San Diego starts to get excited about and work toward. And trust me, if we ever have to see the taillights of the moving vans leaving Murphy Canyon, everyone will get excited about it because they'll have no choice. You know, because at that point it'll become, well, if we don't have a stadium, we've got no shot at ever getting an NFL team back.
Yeah.
And even if we get a stadium, now we are – San Diego could build the stadium and then become the pawn for years of the National Football League. Oh, you better fix your stadium in City XYZ or else you're coming to San Diego. And be held there, kind of like L.A. has for the last 20 years.
Yeah, no kidding.
You know, as just that pawn that you just put out there and say, the difference being that L.A. fans, frankly, and I lived there, didn't care. When the Rams and Raiders left, they were thrilled to get a television doubleheader. And it was much more interesting than those teams that were both poorly supported. Something that people will need to think about in L.A. when football eventually comes back there.
Yeah, but I do remember, Craig, when the Rams would draw over 100,000 people to the L.A. Coliseum.
Yeah.
And they were, boy, what an exciting team they were. And Bob Waterfield and Norm Van Brocklin and Elroy Crazy Legs Hirsch. I mean, they were really exciting, and they were good, and they drew great.
Yeah.
But the Coliseum is not a great place to watch football.
Beyond not know? Great.
You know, and just like San Diego Stadium. I mean, yes, you can get 70,000 people in there, but they probably have fewer really good seats in between the 20-yard lines at either side than – I know this, there are more seats between the baselines for baseball at Petco than there were at San Diego Stadium, even though occasionally you could get over 60,000 people when you had a big promotional event.
Right.
But there are more good baseball seats at Petco than there were at San Diego Stadium.
That's a great point. I sat up in some of those upper deck seats at the Murph as a college kid for Padres baseball, and those seats were definitively not very good.
Yeah.
They were very far away. You talked about getting that job straight out of San Diego State, KFMB, working in news, being there for that golden decade of growth. At one point, weren't you out there? I want to say it was for Channel 7, right? You moved to NBC?
Not directly. And that's I was at Channel 8 for a couple of years.
Okay.
And then a guy named Al Coupe was actually brought to San Diego to broadcast the Charger games in 1961.
Okay.
Ironically, he only did it for 1 year, and then the contract went to KFMB. But Coop was still a dominant sports figure in San Diego. And the one that, when he lost the Charger broadcast deal, spotlighted Don Coryell in San Diego State, and the station put them on the air. And, boy, was that a good move for him, you know, for the next decade or so.
No doubt.
But he hired me as his assistant at Channel 10, Kogo Radio and Channel 10.
Channel 10, not Channel 7. There you go.
But I eventually did go to Channel 39, a sports director in the late 60s.
Hmm.
And it was actually, you may find this hard to believe, it was actually almost like a local ESPN. This was it was a dormant TV station. It had been a pen factory or something, and it started off as Channel 39, was KAAR, Car TV. And it was started by Charlie Brown, who owned the Town and Country Hotel, and was upset at the councilman in San Diego at the time. And so he started his own TV, and as brilliant a hotel manager and operator as he was, he knew nothing about television. And the station went under. It was dormant. Bass Brothers Broadcasting of Dallas, Texas, came in and bought this dormant station and did research and determined that San Diegans were nuts about sports. And so they decided, we'll get people to learn how to get UHF. See, it's a UHF station. Now you think 39, so it's on the cable. There's no cable then.
Right.
You had the channels 2 through 13, VHF, and then 14 and above was UHF. You had to get a special antenna. Television sets then, this is in the late 60s, did not have to have UHF. So you had to go out and get a special antenna in order to receive it. They determined if we put sports on, people will learn how to get that. And so they hired me as sports director. I came over there in 68. Now I'm a kid in a candy store, right?
Right.
We did Charger preseason games and some regular season games, by the way. Eventually did Padre baseball and San Diego Rockets, San Diego Gulls. I did San Diego State football, basketball, baseball, track and field, and rugby.
On the air.
Live telecast.
Wow.
Whatever. Yeah. And we did one game. In those days, NBC showed the World Series.
Mm-hmm.
And they also carried the AFL games, American Football League games. And so on Sunday, when the World Series was on, they did play day games in those days, even the World Series, then they would give up the football team game on television to the station that carried the preseason games in the local market.
Hmm.
So roundabout way of saying that Channel 39 then got to do some regular season games. So I did a Saturday night game from Miami, Florida, the Chargers and the Miami Dolphins.
Holy
did one
cow.
From Kansas City. And got dynamite ratings in San Diego, which proved that, in effect, they were right. People for a major event would learn how to get UHF. They did. Now, what I didn't know was that the strategy of the ownership was to prove that they were a viable station in the San Diego market. And then the ABC network, which was in a foreign country, Channel 6 in Mexico, would have to come to them because that was an FCC rule at the time. And so there was a long battle in the FCC. They finally won, and ABC had to go to Channel 39. But NBC was, ABC then didn't want to come to 39, made a deal with Channel 10. They went to Channel 10. NBC, which was then at Channel 10, went to Channel 39, and that's the way it is today.
Wow.
But that's how it happened.
So it started with them getting the station viable directly through a sports package. But the thing that for anyone who works in the industry now or is just currently follows sports has to blow their mind is that here you are a local station sports director calling NFL, NBA, MLB. So it was obviously the rights packages were nowhere near the same as they
are. Nothing. No. Teams were thrilled to get on. And so, nothing like it is today. Nothing.
What an unreal. You said kid in the candy store. I mean, it goes beyond that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there was no rights fee with San Diego State to put those games on.
They're just like, when can you show up?
Thrilled. We did University of San Diego basketball and baseball. I think we wanted to do Cal Western basketball. They were where Point Loma Nazarene is now, the Golden Gym. But we had the problem of getting a signal out of there or something, so we never did games from them. But we would have done their games.
How many live games did you do a week during that kind of heyday?
Oh, gosh. During basketball and baseball, there were a lot. But it was, it was embryonic compared to what you see today. First of all, it was black and white, in the beginning. Finally got color. But black and white television to start off with. There'd be a three. I can remember, this is 1968. And so it's the Padres of the Pacific Coast League, their last year.
Right.
And they're playing, but they played in San Diego Stadium that year as a minor league team. But we were doing a four-game series from Phoenix against the Phoenix Giants, the AAA team of the San Francisco Giants. So we drive this remote truck over, barely made it through the mountains, whatever. We have three cameras. It's a true story. Home plate camera, first base, and a third base. And I'm doing the game all by myself. It's in May. It's 100 degrees in Phoenix.
Sure.
So,
which stadium were you at? Tempe Diablo? Or
The Phoenix Municipal Stadium.
Phoenix. Okay, yeah. I've been there. Phoenix Muni. Know just about it.
So, it's concrete. And the Oakland A's, were there for until this year they moved out, got the old Cubs place. So anyway, that's where we're doing the game. 10 minutes before the first pitch of the first game, the home plate camera caught on fire. Flames are going up in the air. So now we open the game. The game's not going to wait for us to get things squared away. We open the game. I'm doing the telecast, and we have just a first and a third base camera.
Oh, my God!
In those days, there was no center field camera, which is the best camera
right.
for baseball.
Right.
But nobody had thought about it then. And so if you're watching the game, man, your optic nerves had to be going back and forth.
Oh, my gosh, right, because you're going left side, right side, left side.
Right. We had the whole plate. They finally got it fixed, like about the third inning or something. So we had a home plate camera. But there was this one guy for the Phoenix Giants who was just phenomenal. And after that series, he was called up by the Giants, and he hit a grand slam home run in his first game. It was against the Los Angeles Dodgers, and his name was Bobby Bonds. He later had a son who was pretty good.
Not bad. He wasn't bad. He may make the Hall of Fame someday. We'll see. Well, you wrote a great book, Tales from the Padres.
Yeah.
You had the chance to do that. I know I went back. I read a couple of stories from when you did that. And I know you said it was going to be your only book.
Yeah.
What was your favorite story you left out?
Oh, I pretty much shot my wad in that book. I pretty much told it all. Because it was going to be my one and only.
Right.
Now, there may have been some other stories that have come up that I would have put in, but there's nothing that beats the stories I put in that book, and they're all true.
Yep.
And for those who haven't read it, it's just a series of vignettes of things that happen with the Padres.
Yeah, the last year was, to me, the toughest year in Padres history. And you just talked about one of the darkest years, but to lose Jerry and Tony in the same year.
Just devastating.
And it was. And one right at the start and one right in the middle. One thing I always remembered as a guy who came here in 90, but just following Padres baseball, was that every year you did an interview with Tony at the start of the year. That was kind of your thing, right?
Well, hey, listen, I interviewed Tony almost every excuse I could come up with, you know. But, of course, he was always in the beginning, and he was always about the last one I did, too, because we talk about the playoffs and the Padres weren't going to be in it, but who did he like and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, of those opening day interviews, any of them stand out? I mean, there's been a billion interactions saying, tell me a story about Tony Gwynn. I mean, that would be another 15 hours, but... those moments, because I know Tony was the guy, I always talk about this, Tony was game two guy. Opening day for him, he was kind of a shuffle and kick the dirt on opening day, right?
Oh, yeah, he didn't like opening day, because he said the real baseball fans aren't there on opening day, you know. Starting the second game, that's when the real fans start coming out. Yeah, that was Tony. I mean, gosh, interviewing Tony was like stealing money, you know that. He was... ask him one question and he could fill the time, you know. And he was so much fun to talk to, and he had so many opinions on different subjects, and his laugh would make the interview as good as it was. He was just great in every aspect, as a hitter, as a human being, as a, you know, as a broadcaster, as a subject, an interview guest. He was the best.
He was the best. It's killing me just to even think about a year that's starting without him.
Yeah, listen, when I knew he was sick. I didn't realize it was as bad as it was until it ended in June. And I mean, I probably shouldn't make a juxtaposition, but I thought, here's the greatest hitter in Padre history, dies in June, the year the team hit 171.
Oh, my gosh. It was. It was the low point. I mean, like, you just want to say, where's the low point for the pods? Modern, yeah, there
you know,
it is.
When Jerry Coleman died in January, I've often said it at the time, and I still believe it. He was the most iconic sports figure in the history of San Diego, because he was, I mean, Tony was there from, you know, the time he joined, started playing basketball with San Diego State until he passed away. But Jerry was there from 1972. Until he died, and think how many people heard him do baseball and related to him. And he was such a terrific, he was not only a great broadcaster, but a great person. I never saw Jerry turn down an interview. And he never charged for an interview. I meant a signature, autograph.
Yeah.
Never charged for it and never turned one down. And we'd be leaving the ballpark. I'd be late. He'd be tired. But if anybody asked him, he always stopped and did it. And he believed that in doing what he could to sell the game of baseball. He was all baseball. Jerry was all baseball. Listen, I love baseball, but I love football too, and basketball. I love and golf and the other sports. But for Jerry, it was all baseball.
All the time.
All baseball.
The winner was just getting ready for the next year.
Take him 2 minutes to read the sports page. If there wasn't anything on baseball, you'd just go on to something else.
You had more time with Jerry than probably almost his wife. I mean, in terms of just hours spent.
Well,
and when you factor in road trips and travel and just the kind of humdrum nature of announcing for a ball club, where you're going from here to there, setting up, tearing down, pre-games and post-games, and all of that time. And what is the thing that when people from the outside, people who didn't know Jerry, you know, we have many things that we think of. You know, I mean, we could just talk about how the statue is set up and putting his life into those areas as a war hero, as a broadcaster, as an amazing ball player. But what's the thing about Jerry that maybe people don't know or wouldn't come easily to them based on his public persona?
Well, you know, he was a terrific baseball player in a great era in New York with the Yankees. He wore number 42, And he and Howard Cosell were very close friends.
Hmm.
But Cosell used to call him Jerry Coleman, number 42 for the New York Yankees, the wrong 42. Well, the reason he said that, and you may not know this part of it, but in the 50s, Jackie Robinson, of course, was 42 for the right. Brooklyn Dodgers, and Charlie Connerly, the quarterback for the New York Football Giants, wore 42. Now, you can't have that today. You have certain numbers for certain positions.
Right.
But they didn't then. He was 42, you know. Otto Graham, when he quarterbacked the Cleveland Browns, was number 70. That's just the way it was.
Supposed to be a center now.
Yeah, you know. But so I knew of Jerry Coleman quite a bit. Now, I'm still a young sportscaster in San Diego. We both got hired in November of 1971 by the Padres to be their broadcast team starting in 72. So I had never met him personally. So when we met, he couldn't have been nicer, trying to put me at ease, whatever. And Craig, not all broadcast booths are like this, but we started off, I'm a rookie major league announcer here
yeah.
in 72. And Jerry said, look, you pick whoever you want for your post-game interview. You know, that's your baby. You do whatever. And at that time, Jerry did 7 innings of play-by-play, and I did 2.
Which 2?
I would do the 3rd and the 7th, I think it was.
Oh, so you didn't even get 2 in a row?
No. Oh, no. No. After a couple of years, I graduated to 3 innings, did 3rd and 4th and 7th.
Okay. All right.
And Jerry would do the pregame interview, and I'd do the postgame, whatever. And, I mean, even I'm not sure how it is now, but even with the Dodgers, when Jerry Doggett was there with Vin Scully, Scully would tell Doggett who to have on his postgame show.
Hmm.
And but Jerry made it clear, no, you do that. It may seem like a little thing, but it was important at the time.
Yeah, you were teammates, not yeah, one, two.
Yeah, yeah, he told me one time, Bob, it's a long season and a small booth, so we need to get along. And we never had a serious argument the whole time. The
wow.
whole time we worked together, never. And it was so much fun for me. In the beginning, you know, first impressions, that first year, 72, I'm going to these major league cities, and we stay. One thing about major league travel, you stay in great hotels. We stay in the best hotels, and I'm seeing these stadiums for the first time, traveling on this plane, having a lot of spare time, having breakfast. And I would sit with Jerry Coleman, and he would just tell me baseball stories, and I would ask him about those Yankee teams, which I despised at the time. They always won. We wanted to root for the Yankees.
Right.
And my team, because I told you my dad was a Navy officer. He was stationed in Washington, D.C. when I first got interested in baseball. And so my team was the Washington Senators, the original Senators. They never had a winning record the whole time I rooted for them. They finally moved to Minnesota in 1961, and they became pretty good. But until then, they were the woe-begotten Washington Senators. So Jerry told me, he said, you know, Bob, those Washington Senator teams, let me tell you how bad they really were. And so all these heroes of mine, Eddie Stewart and Gil Cohn and Eddie Yost, the walking man, and different these people, he says, look, we in those days, you played each team 22 times, 11 at home, 11 on the road. There were 8 teams, 7 others you played, 154-game schedule. He said, if we didn't beat Washington 19 out of 22, we considered it a bad year.
That's a lofty goal. That is hilarious. Oh, my gosh. Bob Chandler, we've hit a lot. We've hit a lot. I think we could probably go 4 more hours. I mean, I have a feeling we could do this some more.
Listen, I could fill with the best of them.
Right?
Think of all those innings I had to fill with those bad Padre teams.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my goodness. No kidding. No kidding. You've done it. Good stuff, man. Thank you for coming out.
My pleasure. Really was.
All right, that's it. That's our show. That's the Craig Elston Podcast, number 6, wrapping things up. Our thanks to Bob Chandler. Great stuff. Hope you really enjoyed that interview as much as I enjoyed doing it. Each one of these guys we bring in, I tell you what, it's a real pleasure for me. If you've missed any of our past podcasts, search for my name here on the Mighty 1090 website. I've got a show page now. We're stacking them up. still working on some of the behind-the-scenes logistics, trying to get this bad boy into the phone app. That is coming soon. Special thanks to station management, starting with our digital editor, Jay Paris, and Wendy Freireich, who is in charge of putting this thing together and on the air every Friday. I'm Craig Elston. We'll talk to you next week. Have a great weekend, everybody.